That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year. As this, the third year of the Great World War, opened, American citizens realized first
that during the closing days of 1916, President Woodrow Wilson had directed Secretary of State Robert Lansing to make the appeal
that an early occasion be sought to call out from all nations now at war such an avowal of their respective views as to the terms upon which the war might be concluded.
Second,
that Germany had replied for herself and her allies.
The imperial government begs to propose an immediate meeting of delegates of the belligerent states at a neutral place.
Third,
Great Britain, France, Belgium, and the other Entente powers, after placing the blame for the war upon Germany and Austria-Hungary, declined to discuss peace terms with the concluding statement,
the Allies are determined to act with all their power and to consent to all sacrifices to bring to a victorious close the conflict upon which they are convinced not only their own safety and prosperity depend, but also the future of civilization itself.
As this, the third year of the Great World War, opened, American citizens realized that it was to continue, that the U.S. was being drawn farther and farther away from an avowed course of neutrality, closer and closer toward conflict. And the long exchange of notes with Germany on the matter of the many sinkings of American and Allied ships bearing American passengers and seamen was brought to a dramatic culmination when on January 31, Count Johann von Bernstorff delivered to the State Department a memorandum to the effect that
from February 1st, 1917, within barred zones around Great Britain, France, Italy, and in the Eastern Mediterranean, all sea traffic of it will be opposed.
This daring ultimatum concluded with five stipulations as to the manner in which Germany would allow U.S. ships to sail the Atlantic. One,
if Falmouth is taken as a destination.
Two,
if U.S. ships will travel a designated route.
Three,
if U.S. ships will bear a coating of paint in vertical stripes alternating red and white on every mast, a large flag of checkered white and red, on this turn the American national flag.
Four,
if only one steamer runs each week in each direction, arriving at Falmouth on Sundays, leaving Falmouth on Wednesdays.
Five,
if the American government guarantees to Germany that no ship carries contraband according to the German list of contraband.
At once, of course, the American nation arose in angry resentment. Germany had abrogated her assurance of May 4, 1916, in which she had guaranteed safe passage for American ships. And so it was with heavy heart that Woodrow Wilson appeared before a joint session of the Congress on February 3, 1917, to disavow his second term slogan, "He kept us out of war," and announced that all diplomatic relations between the United States and the German Empire are severed.
The White House, February 24.
Yes?
Mr. President?
Yes, Mr. Lansing?
I must see you immediately.
Very well. Come right over. Well, I've just received the most audacious piece of news.
We've just decoded a cable from Ambassador Page. The British Secret Service has intercepted and deciphered a note from Alfred Zimmermann, Undersecretary of the German Foreign Affairs Ministry, to the German Ambassador to Mexico.
Mexico?
Listen to this, Mr. Wilson. It's dated January 19 from Berlin. On the 1st of February, we intend to begin submarine warfare unrestricted. In spite of this, it is our intention to endeavor to keep neutral the United States of America. If this attempt is not successful, we propose an alliance on the following basis with Mexico. That we shall make war together, and together make peace. We shall give general financial support, and it is understood that Mexico is to reconquer the lost territory in New Mexico, Texas, and Arizona.
Why, Lansing, that's a hoax.
That's what I thought, Mr. President, and I cabled for verification. Mr. Page replied with the German text of the note.
We must keep this quiet for a few days. No word of it must leak out. Do you understand?
Quite. And I absolutely agree with you. This would mean war within 24 hours.
Not quite 24 hours. But when this famous Zimmermann note was made public on February 28th, it incited an already bitter anti-German sentiment into a flame of active protest.
Washington, D.C., April 2, 8:30 p.m.
As a soft spring rain drizzles down upon the illuminated dome of the national capital, the President of the United States addresses the House and Senate in joint session.
It is a fearful thing to lead this great peaceful people into war, into the most terrible and disastrous of all wars, civilization itself seeming to be in the balance. But the right is more precious than peace, and we shall fight for the things which we have carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own government, for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal domination of right by such a consort of free peoples as shall bring peace and safety to all nations and make the world itself at last free. To such a task, we can dedicate our lives and our fortunes, everything that we are and everything that we have, with the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principles that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured. God helping her, she can do no other.
Four days later, in the early morning hours of April 6, Congress passes the resolution
that the state of war between the United States and the Imperial German government, which has been thrust upon the United States, is hereby formally declared.
America was officially at war. On the day war broke out, the total organized military strength of the U.S. regular army and militia was only 208,219 men and officers, a woefully inadequate force with which to enter the world's most embracing conflict. Approaching the tremendous problem with misgivings and with minds forewarned by apprehensive memories of the rioting and bloodshed attendant upon conscription during the Civil War and the commotion resulting from the volunteer system during the Spanish-American War, Secretary Newton D. Baker and his War Department colleagues finally hit upon a plan. He would make of a registration for the draft not a military procedure, but a festival and patriotic occasion. On May 18, the Conscription Act was signed and became the most important law of the nation. At once, notices were posted in almost every language spoken in the U.S.
Attention! On Tuesday, June 5th, every male between the ages of 21 years and 31 years, whether a citizen of the United States or not a citizen of the United States, must register at the nearest voting place in his ward.
Throughout the nation, from Seattle to Tampa, from Penobscot Bay to the Gulf of Santa Catalina, from factories, from mills, from farms, from offices, from schools and universities, they poured into polling places, registered not by hard-boiled uniformed recruiting sergeant, but by the men and women who checked their parents' ballots. Then came the day of the drawing, July 20, 1917. In the public hearing room of the Senate office building in Washington, a group of distinguished officials stand in front of a huge blackboard bearing stenciled numbers from 1 to 10,500. In the center is Secretary of War Newton Deal Baker, who stands before a large glass fishbowl containing hundreds of tiny capsules.
You ready, Mr. Secretary?
Yes. Tie the blindfold over my eyes, please.
Yes.
There. There, that's fine. Thank you.
All right, sir. Your hand is right over the bowl.
All right. There's the first capsule.
And the first number is 258.
Number 258. From 4,500 precincts throughout the country, registrant number 258 knew within a few moments that he was the first man from his ward to be drawn for service. On and on, from 9:49 a.m. to past 2 o'clock the next morning, the drawing continued, until at last more names had been drawn than the army needed. Then the job of building cantonments and camps to house this vast new armed force. It was a prodigious task. 16 cantonments and 16 camps had to be constructed, a task second only to the building of the Panama Canal. Within a few months, thousands of youthful Americans doffed their civilian clothes and donned the ODs, the olive drab of the U.S. Army. Thousands of rookies were learning a new life and a new language to fit it. They were learning that the brass hats headed by Jaggy would haul you into a CM if you went AWOL. Then they'd probably slap you into the doggy dog and you'd be SOL. They were learning to eat monkey meat and goldfish. They were learning under the snappy commands of new shaved tails to fall out, fall in, right dress. They were learning the mysteries of KP, and at last, they'd be doughboys. But even the most gigantic war in history couldn't stop America from singing. And in this year of 1917, the country first sang the sparkling song narrative.
I'll be down to get you in a taxi, honey. You better be ready about a 8:30. Now, dearie, don't be late. I want to be there when the band starts playing. Remember when we get there, honey, the two-step I'm going to have them all.
Oh, the dance up of my shoes when we play the jelly roll blues. Tomorrow night at the dark time starters ball. An invitation to the Darktown Ball. It's a very swell affair. All the highbrows will be there. I'll wear my high-silk hat and a frock tail coat.
I'll wear a merry-gown and a new-billed show. There ain't no doubt about it, babe.
We'll be the best dressed in the hall.
Will you come and get me in the taxi, honey?
Gonna
be here about a 8:30.
Lockdown.
Now, dearie, don't be late.
Thank you.